Now the question is, if I don't go to prison, or if I went to prison only very briefly, I assume I don't go to prison if I'm not convicted. Okay, so if I'm not in prison and walking on the streets, what would I do? Well, I think I would continue to work in the establishment of a multiple state network, abortion network, linked with women's liberation groups in different cities, which we've been able to establish through my running around and traveling and link those, some of those groups together into a more effective force, both political as well as meeting the very specific needs of women for control over their own bodies. I think that I would take a strong line and try to promote gay liberation kinds of things that are starting. I think that's really important. I think mostly, however, I would try to add in my clumsy way to some kind of constructed form, new form, which would somehow integrate cultural and political styles so that people would feel comfortable about who they are and not look for other people in other places to make the revolution for them, but to begin to be able to make it for themselves. It's clear the revolution in America proceeds exactly as far as we are. By we, I don't mean the defendants. I mean the folk that are listening. As far as our own consciousness takes it, that's exactly as far as the revolution is. People are not going to make it for us. And we have to find some ways to bring together dope in the shotgun, I guess.
Abby, how do you, now that the trial is almost over, how do you see the trial as having gone?
Yeah, it's, well, it's long. It's sort of an agonizing ordeal in its entirety, but just remarking today, you know, you can have a an outburst, say, in the morning, or a whole drama being played forth, and then you break for lunch, and you come back, and what happens in the afternoon is entirely unrelated to the morning. It's as if you're watching, it's as if I've just seen something like 800 movies, you know, and each movie is unconnected with the next, and these movies or plays get played out before my eyes right in the courtroom. I have a good seat. I mean, but it's quite, I absolutely could not conceive of ever going to a play again after having seen the trial. Of course, I might not get the chance for about 11 years, but well, it's interesting. I mean, you get a full learning of the law and how it's used in this country, and how the trial is more a symbol than we even anticipated when we were talking about the trial before it happened, because it's quite clear that what is on trial is our very being, that the way we dress, the way we wear our hair, our attitude, our language, our defiance of authority in the courtroom, I think are the number one key is the number one key issue on trial. Secondly, the second issue is what happened in the streets of Chicago, and the jurors and the judges and the prosecutors' view about law and order, the war in Vietnam, racism, cultural revolution, young people in general, marijuana, those kinds of issues. And third or fourth down the list, you'll get the evidence in the trial. But the evidence is, the judge will constantly say to the jury, you must disregard everything but the evidence. The evidence is as if it's some god. And it just shows that his concept of communication and the kind of authority and rigid structure that he's trying to protect or has wound up in the evidence is gone like some dinosaur into mud. I mean, anybody would know that the evidence is of very little relevance in this case. And secondly, I think the whole structure of the court system is just totally irrelevant and inappropriate. You see, there is this image. There's been a Walker Commission report. They've called it a police riot. There have been 27 books on what happened in Chicago. Everybody watched it for hours and hours on television. But somehow it's a big mess. And at last, now that there's a trial in a court, in a federal court, with two opposing sides, now we'll get to the truth. But nothing could be further apart from it. What's happening in the court is more removed from the truth of what happened in Chicago than any of the other forms of communication.
How do you feel the alternate lifestyle has been put on trial both by the prosecution and by the defense?
Well, it's more than just a lifestyle. It's a total movement. For example, last week, Professor Kalish, chairman of the philosophy department at UCLA. He'll be questioned about how much money he gave to the resistance in 1967, a group that wasn't even active in Chicago. I'll go on as a witness, and I'll be questioned about a speech that I gave 3 weeks ago in Baltimore. It's some weird Kafkaesque, Brave New World trick of the imagination to figure out how a speech I gave 3 weeks ago is related to my intent in coming to Chicago, which happened almost 2 years ago now. But somehow the government can figure it out. And I think what's clear is that we are on trial for every action, the actions that we did this morning. We're on trial. This interview, interviews that we give with the press, speeches that we give. The government's going around subpoenaing them, because if they don't get us on this trial, they want to try us for obstructing justice. Conspiracy to obstruct justice. I mean, they're like the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and they're just determined to get their men. And we're in the same building that Jimmy Hoffa was sent away for 10 years. And they had a vendetta against him. The federal government wanted to put him away, and they try him 3-4 times. It didn't matter, you know.
In other words, this isn't the only charge that came out of convention week.
No, I had 10 arrests in the year following what happened in Chicago. I mean, no sooner did I get back in New York that the Justice Department, the FBI, the Internal Revenue Service were all lined up. I was visited 5 or 6 times within a week after that. I sort of had been discovered at that point, I guess you'd call it. But they know that the actions that were taken here in Chicago revealed too much about the democratic process in this country, how the convention was rigged from the beginning, and that the convention process is in fact a paper tiger, and it can be wrecked quite easily. We said that it was our aim to come to disrupt the convention. We didn't mean that we were going to literally get inside the hall, you know, and start pulling Hubert Humphrey's hair out, you know, and punching around Mayor Daley. No, we knew quite well that there would be thousands and thousands of guards and thousands of miles of barbed wire and helicopters and tanks and everything in the streets. We knew that image itself was disruptive, that America was revealing itself, and the way it carries on its democratic process is no different than that which carried out in Greece right now under a dictatorship of Franco carries out in Spain. All it has to do is that people have to get up and exert their right freedom of speech and assembly in a very forceful way and be determined not to be scared away, and the government has to mobilize this tremendous amount of force. And I think because of our action, Nixon knows full well that the Republicans cannot have a convention in 1972 in a major city in America. In fact, I doubt if any political party ever will again in the history of this country. I look forward to all political conventions being held in Hawaii from now on, because it's actually the center of the military empire. The United States has shifted eastward to the Southeast Asia, and there they get the most protection, and it's hardest for the large numbers of people who now, about 75% live in urban areas. It's hardest for those people, you see, to express their grievances and their outrage at the point of decision making. Of course, that is, in the American political process, that is the only point of decision-making, or anything that resembles decision-making.
Now that the conspiracy trial is almost over and most people are pretty well assured that the defendants, including yourself, you know, are going to do time in jail, if not on the conspiracy charge itself, on contempt of court, do you think that this whole process is going to stop other people from expressing their dissent, you know, in terms of their own lifestyle?
I think it does have a chilling effect. I mean, there has been a definite slack in types of activity that have gone, a protest activity on campuses and in the streets. I think that Nixon's policy of repression has proved somewhat effective. Sad to say that, but I think it has. I'm not so sure that we're going to lose on the exact charge. In fact, quite the contrary, I think we're going to win or get a hung jury, which is a victory, and it would be a clear victory in this case, a case in which the government has spent something like $5 million in 8 months with a grand jury and another 6 months on trial. I mean, poor Schultz there has been like living with the events in Chicago every day for more than a year, and he's going to blow his brains out when he loses the case, because they have no case, and I think we are going to win in that sense. But I think the judge is going to commit an act of revenge and vengeance and send us away for a good number of years for contempt, ranging from, say, a year for the lawyers to 3 or 4 or 5, possibly 5 years for Dave Dellinger and the rest of us falling somewhere in between. There's probably some justice in it, because we are guilty of contempt for the court. I mean, we were contemptuous the day we walked in. But I think we've done our job well. I mean, I think we've discredited the institutions of the court. We've delegitimatized that authority. I mean, you'll see movement people, probably 5,000 or 6,000 that have now come through and sat in the classroom of the court and totally dehumanized, totally sit there like puppets. I mean, they're taught, don't smile, they're told by the marshals, don't laugh, no fidgeting, none of this, no writing, no buttons, you know, totally searched, and they accept it. They accept this total process of being stripped of most of their goods on them, you know, and of their whole identity and of their personality, that they shouldn't laugh, they shouldn't moan, they shouldn't chuckle, they should exhibit no human emotion. And they accept it the way that the Jews accepted Nazi Germany, you see. And that's been one of the failings, because what we're trying to say by our actions is that this isn't the church. This isn't sacrosanct, and it isn't just order. The judge isn't the king, and he isn't a god, and justice doesn't flow from his brow, you know, the way all humanity flowed from the head of Zeus. People ought to recognize that he's not, although he's a symbol of authority, he really has no power when you're determined to struggle for what you believe in and to stand up for what you think is justice and right. And therefore, it's a conflict between our power and his authority, which we recognize as illegitimate. And I think we're doing fairly well in that sense. And that's why I think people around the country who are active in the movement are sensitive to problems of civil liberties have to take an interest in the trial, because we already have a number of lawyers around the country doing extensive research on the whole issue of contempt, because contempt is the most tyrannical weapon that the judge has to use against people. It's subject to the least amount of appeal, and it's very difficult to get it before a jury and to get it switched from another judge, even though this judge is very personally involved in the case. So there are a number of court battles that have to go on and have to be fought around the issue of contempt, around the inevitability that the judge will deny us bail, for example, on contempt. And that whole process has to be fought, because we've now set the pace for movement trials. If defendants choose to go into a courtroom for a political case because they were involved in demonstrations or something like that, they cut their hair, they put on a suit and tie, they hang their head in shame for what they've done, the way trials have been conducted in the past, if they carry on that kind of a defensive attitude, it's not going to be a political trial, because you have to immediately take the offense. You have to say that the judge, the prosecutor, the government that's putting you on trial is the conspiracy, and they're the ones that are guilty. And it's a case of the criminals acting like the victims and treating the victims as criminals, and you have to adopt that attitude. So I think that trials like this in the future are going to be conducted in this way. And I think we have to really make our fight within the courts. I mean, there's now very competent legal authorities, like they have, for example, the head of the Illinois Bar Association, that says because of our tactics, which, by the way, I should point out, they're not disruptive of the court process as such. I mean, the trial can still go on. Many of the comments to the judge are very short. They're made out of the presence of the jury. Process of, say, not rising for the judge is done very early, and then people rise. They don't take up very much time, and they're not disruptive to the total process. But to the image of the court, you see, to the image of the court's dignity and decorum, as the judge refers to it, were tremendously disruptive. I mean, all of us have some concept of the media. You know, we know, I know, that I do a somersault, I do a handstand downstairs on the sidewalk, you know, in front of the court building on the day it opens, you see, that by the time that hits the East Coast or the West Coast, that was done in the middle of the courtroom in front of the judge, you see. And then the judge reads out in the paper the next day and say, I will not have my courtroom turned into a circus. But you see, nothing's happening in the room. But mythically, everything is going on in the room. I think people around the country have a view of this trial as one of total chaos, defendants fighting with marshals on the floor, people coming in naked, the judge jerking off in his chair, you know, witnesses standing up and screaming bloody murder, people running around with guns and bombs, and that's the image that we've created of the trial without actually having done any of those things. The whole thing's done with mirrors.
How do you feel the image of the courts in the minds of the average American has changed because of the conspiracy trial?
Well, I mean, Judge Hoffman certainly fits the bill. You see, one of the problems is, and Julius is a two-edged sword, because although he certainly shows up all the idiocies and of a court, you know, and the idiocies of this law and the senility of the government, people can place the blame on him rather than on the system of the courts itself. You see, it's the same way that he's in a way acting out the Mayor Daley myth, which is people said, well, what happened in the streets of Chicago was a result of Mayor Daley, you see. Not recognizing that it was a result of outrage on the part of the people, and that the democratic process does not serve the needs of the people, and that a new kind of political system has to be developed in this country. They don't recognize that. You've got to choose a chief villain. To explain the fact that young people, got pounded and beaten in the streets and parks of Chicago. So the same thing goes on in the courts. Rather than deny, a liberal attitude is not to deny the legitimacy of the courts, you see, as an instrument in maintaining those in power, but they say that, well, he's an old kook judge, you know, that's what it is. But I mean, he's no kookier than other judges. He's, by some standards, he's young. I mean, the Spock trial had an 86-year-old judge, you know. Was older than Julius. Julius is old. I mean, old in his ways and old in his thinking and old. If you watch him, I mean, you watch today, the way in which he gets threatened is when you attack his little section of the ooze. He's like guarding this little section of the ooze, the primeval ooze. He's like some reptilian creature, you know, just sits in the corner of the jungle, and this is my room, me and me Spandero, the world's foremost architect designed it, and, you know, here it's all falling apart because we come in, you know, with our boots and hair and turn the table into a commune and put out a NLF flag or something or sit around and don't respect his authority. He attacks, he says, you cannot do that at the table of the government, you know. We say, we ain't government's table. It's our table, man. It's a liberated zone, you know. They're lucky we haven't sentenced them to more. I mean, I sent Schultz a note today, again, saying, you know,
for 50 grand, we'd stop the trial and let them off. Because it's quite clear in our minds that the trial has backfired for them. You know, that they've ended up being the ones put on trial, discredited. But of course, that's a risky procedure. Revolution involves risks, and you can get your hair cut and your ass kicked and get sent off to prison, and that's where I suppose we're going.
On a personal level, how do you feel about going to prison?
I don't like it, I'll tell you. I mean, I've seen Johnny Cash. It's not all a James Cagney movie. I think I've had about 40 arrests, and about 28 or so of them have ended up in a trial. So the most I've been in jail has been one night, and that one night has been a nightmare. And I'm not looking forward to spending, a long time in jail. We're going to have a motion, though, at the end if we're sent to jail, to have the time we spent on trial deducted from the sentence. I think about that'll be the first time that's ever been tried. I think we have the longest trial in history.
John, you and Lee Weiner in particular have become widely known, even notorious, in the last few months for being unknown. Would you talk about the special significance that has and what you represent in the case?
I think that there are two elements about that. One is why were we indicted? Why pick out two people who weren't nationally known? Why pick out two people who weren't seen as part of the national leadership, if there is such a thing? Why pick out people who weren't the primary foci in Chicago? And I think that there's one answer to that can be given, and that is that if the Nixon administration, in this case, is attempting a trial balloon, the beginnings of overt repression against the movement, then the scenario it wants to draw is a scenario where it encompasses the entire movement. So you have Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin as cultural revolutionaries. You have Tom Hayden and Rennie Davis representing SDS to some extent, and the anti-war movement in particular, the new left, so to speak. And you have David Dellinger representing the pacifist framework and the anti-war movement, clearly. And then, of course, to round out the scenario, it's good for the government to throw in two people from the academic community. That is Lee Weiner, who's a graduate student, and me, who is a university faculty member. And I think that what that does for them is to, in a sense, be able to provide a so-called chilling effect against the entire movement, because the people on the outside perceive the situation as being limited to no one, but being much more broad-based in the scope of the kind of repression that the Nixon administration would like to initiate. The second thing about being an unknown that's quite relevant is that in terms of the law, in terms of the repression that is likely to or possibly going to come down, it's important for people who sit in light positions. That is, people who are sympathetic, active, and even, in some respects, constant participants in the movement, but yet nationally unknown in many respects, to understand that the pervasiveness of the repression, the pervasiveness of the law is such that they can be part of these kinds of indictments, particularly conspiracy indictments, for doing virtually nothing, and that they can be indicted without having the kind of notoriety that people like Abby or Tom might have. That what the Nixon administration wants to do is not simply to rid the movement of a certain kind of leadership, but it's to destroy the movement. It's to, in effect, destroy what's grown up in this country in the past 10 years, and which I think is represented, by and large, by the people in trial in this case. And I think what the trial has essentially given us through the media, through speaking, through literature, has been an ability to reach a large number of people around the country. Now, it's no panacea. I think that The one thing that may be important is that it may be important for us to go to jail, though. Even though a lot of people know about this trial, I think in terms of the movement, it may be important for us to go to jail, because I don't think that, well, as I said earlier, there's been no chilling effect. But at the same time, the movement still doesn't, I think, realize how serious the potential for the repression is. The movement doesn't take itself seriously a lot of the time. The movement, in many respects, is defeatist. Carries out a lot of activities in which we expect to lose rather than to win. We portray ourselves very often as victims rather than as warriors. And I think that this trial is going to prove one thing, and that is if people go to jail, the movement is going to have to take itself serious, and it's going to learn that it has to fight. It's going to learn that it has to, in fact, see itself as warriors rather than victims.
What discrepancy do you see in the way the 20 to 30 million people have been reached about this trial and what the trial has really meant? And another way to put that is, what has the media filter attempted to do to this trial?
Yeah, well, it's the media has acted in a classic kind of way. The media takes out the antics. They focus on people like Abby Hoffman. They focus on the badness of the judge or the repressiveness of the courtroom situation. But they screen all the politics from the case. They don't in any way treat the judge as symptomatic of the American judicial system, and he is. He's been this way throughout all his trials, and he's certainly not an isolated kind of judge. In fact, since the trial began, we've come in contact with other people around the country who are in similar kinds of court cases, and their judges are all the same as Judge Hoffman. There's no big difference. And so one thing the media has done is screened out our own criticisms of the American judicial system as it exists on a broad level. The second thing it screened out has been our politics. We can give press conferences and talk about the war and talk about racism, and the media will not pick it up at all. They'll pick up the fact that we criticize the judge for not letting in our politics, but they won't discuss the politics. And in fact, they refuse to deal with the issues. The media has particularly refused to deal with some of our very real criticisms about Vietnam and even carrying that further, particularly about imperialism, of course.
What's been the effect of the defense, and for that matter the prosecution, and this whole experience on the jury as you assess it now near the end of the trial?
I would say that, that unlike the Oakland 7 jury, they haven't been educated, although I'm not convinced of that. They haven't been educated to the political issues in the trial. They certainly don't seem responsive to the issues. But then I have no experience with watching juries in the past, so I don't know.
Were they not educated by Bobby Seale?
Well, I still think that there's a definite split within the jury. Some jurors were educated by Bobby Seale, although I think for them it was confusing because they were taken out of the courtroom at a moment's notice, and so they never got the entire context in which Bobby was operating, although being chained and gagged doesn't require much context. It's pretty symbolic by itself. But I would say, if anything, that thing has been the most crucial, easily the most crucial element of Trump.
There have been how many witnesses for the defense and how many for the prosecution, and what's been the effect on you personally just of the length of the trial and spending this much time in the city of Chicago?
There's been about 100 witnesses for the defense. There were about 55 witnesses for the prosecution. And spending this time in Chicago has been shit as far as I'm concerned. I hate Chicago. I think that nobody should live here if they don't have to. We've been so tied up with this trial that we have not been able to do anything in the city on a local level politically, that our presence in Chicago has been through the media at best, and that I think trials have a degenerating effect on people in general. I don't think they're good movement activity. I think that the people in this trial could have been more effective out in the streets rather than locked in the courtroom. And
that's one of the reasons you're in the courtroom?
Well, I think there are inherent limitations in trying to put politics through a courtroom, although I think this trial has been as good as is ever going to occur. but that, I mean, without just destroying the courtroom, which I think is the way things should go.
If you don't go to jail, what will you do?
personally.
Mm-hmm.
Probably go to Boston or California, and I will probably start working on ecological pollution problems, trying to develop a national organization of political people concerned with it, rather than having it be co-opted by the Nixon administration or liberal reformers who simply want to reform the institutions of corporate capitalism such that they can rid themselves of pollution. But I don't think that's right. I think we need political people to function in that area to create some awareness about the, finally about why that all that pollution actually occurs.
Do you consider Julius Hoffman part of the pollution problem?
I think Judge Hoffman is a pollution problem which should be dealt with like some of the... Never mind.